We're going to be spending time in Exodus this morning. We've been studying the book of Exodus over the last little over a year now, and we will actually, believe it or not, even though we're in, we're going to cross over into chapter 22, we're going to finish this up in June. So we are really going to hit the fast forward button here in a few weeks as we seek to study this book. And the title of this kind of mini-series in Exodus is entitled Love Your God, Love Your Neighbor. So we've been taking a look at the section that's just right after the Ten Commandments as God expands on some of the Ten Commandments in this section. So with that, if you have a Bible, go ahead and open up to Exodus chapter 21, and we'll be picking up in verse 33 this morning. If you don't have a Bible with you, there should be one in a chair in front of you or close to a chair in front of you. And we invite you to take that and to use it. If that is the only Bible you own, if you don't have one, we encourage you to take it home with you to keep it. It's our gift to you. And we would encourage you to read God's word on your own. Well, when my brother was in junior high, he invited a whole bunch of people to our church, a lot of friends and family, and along with his cousin. And so we went to church, we had a huge meal afterwards, and then after the meal, we ventured out into the church parking lot, and we played a game of softball. And our church parking lot was this huge gravel parking lot. We were out in the country, and I know that doesn't make for like the ideal softball field for a lot of you guys. We're kind of spoiled here in Muscatine. But for us, that was ideal. It was just a huge open lot, and that was kind of our church activity, that anytime we had a Sunday school picnic, VBS, or whatever, we were out in that parking lot playing softball. And so this one kid, Robert, one of my brother's good friends, got up to bat, and we were just kind of slow pitch, lobbing it up in there. And Robert got a hold of one, and this ball made a beeline for our church. And it didn't just make the beeline for our church, it made a beeline for a window in our church. And it didn't just make a beeline for any window in our church, it made a beeline for one of our large stained glass windows in our church's sanctuary. It went right through the window and absolutely shattered the stained glass window in our church. What's the proper response in this situation? Should the young man have offered to pay for this broken window? Or given the fact that he's in junior high and doesn't have like any money to his own credit, surely not enough to pay for a huge stained glass window in a sanctuary, should he have offered to pay for part of it? Should my family, being the host of the event, should they have stepped in and said, you know what, we invited him, we'll go ahead and cover it? Since it was a church, should the church have stepped in and said, you know what, no worries, we'll take one for the team? Well, this morning, as we spend time in God's word, we'll be taking a look at the topic of restitution, or making things right, particularly as it relates to taking advantage of others or damaging their property. And as we study these laws, I firmly believe that all of us here this morning are going to be greatly challenged as we seek to make amends down the road when we damage others' property, when we take advantage of others. But as we do, there are two things that I want us to keep in mind as we study this passage. First, we need to understand that these laws represent categories of laws. And so, for example, one of the things we'll talk about is what happens when we steal property. And God will give a few examples. Well, God isn't just saying, okay, well, you only get punished if you steal these three or four things. God is saying, no, anytime you steal something, this is the punishment. And so these represent categories. It's not an exhaustive list of laws. And secondly, as we talked about a few weeks ago, we need to remember that these laws were written when Israel was a theocracy, when it was ruled and judged directly by God, which is no longer the case in our society. And therefore, we ultimately need to apply all of these laws through the filter of Jesus and the gospel into our modern-day context. So how we're going to approach these verses today is I'm going to read through this section, and I'm actually going to explain the verses as I read through the section, and then we'll go back and we'll apply the passage as a whole. And so here we go, beginning in chapter 21, verses 33. It says, when a man opens a pit, or when a man digs a pit and does not cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restoration. He shall give money to its owner, and the dead beast shall be his. So the situation here is a man digs a pit or digs a well, and the neighbor's livestock wander in and fall into the pit. And so pretty much this was like a death sentence for the animal. There was no way that they would be able to lift the animal out of the pit. And so God says that the owner of the pit shall make restoration, that because he was negligent, that because he didn't cover the pit, that he owes the neighbor a reward or some restitution. And what we see here is that the restitution is that he shall give money to its owner, but the dead beast the owner shall keep. And we're actually going to see today that this is actually going to be one of the lighter penalties in this section. And the reason is that the person who owns the ox or owns the donkey bears some responsibility for this crime or this fault, because he let his own livestock wander onto the neighbor's property, right? So he's saying, well, you're at fault. But then this other guy, he's also at fault for leaving this pit uncovered. And so the correct way to deal with this, to make amends, to bring about reconciliation, is that you would give money to the owner and the dead beast, then the owner of the pit shall keep. In verse 35, when one man's ox butts another so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and share its price, and the dead beast also they shall share. Or if it is known that the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past and its owner has not kept it in, he shall repay ox for ox, and the dead beast shall be his. All right, so we see penalties kind of ramping up here a little bit. It says when one man's ox butts another so that it dies, so the animal dies here, but only one person is at fault. It says then the owner of the ox that has killed the other one shall sell his ox, and then the two shall share its price, and the dead beast they shall also share. So we see that the punishment is ramped up a little bit. It says, or if it is known that the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past and its owner has not kept it in, he shall repay ox for ox, and the dead beast shall be his. So basically, if the owner bears, instead of it being an accident, if the owner says, you know what, this ox, it's been pretty brutal to other oxen in the past or other animals in the past, but, you know, I'm just going to let it go, not going to worry about it. But if it gores another animal and kills it, then God says, you know what, the penalty needs to be ramped up here, and you need to repay ox for ox. That basically, back then, the only way to really plow a field was to have oxen. And it takes a while to train an ox. And so God says, money doesn't suffice here. You can't just pay money, because then the person has to go out and buy another ox, and then they have to train it, whereas they had a well-trained oxen prior to this. And so God says you need to pay an ox. You need to give them yours. You were negligent. That killed another ox. You now have to make restitution out of what you own. Verse 22, if a man steals an ox or a sheep and kills it or sells it, he shall repay five oxen for an ox and four sheep for a sheep. So now we kind of get into theft here. And God institutes a pretty harsh penalty in order to prevent people or keep people from even thinking about stealing. I mean, just thinking about that. If you go in and you were to say, you know what, I could rob this bank and probably get $100,000, but if I'm caught, then I owe $400,000 or $500,000 to the bank. How many of you would say, yeah, that's worth the risk right there? John Hessling is going to probably watch, like, who raises their hand here. But yeah. But that, the whole point is that God is trying to say, I'm going to make the penalty steep enough so that you don't do it. That they would have to pay four or five oxen or four sheep just for stealing one ox or one sheep. Verse 22, if a thief is found breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there shall be no blood guilt for him. But if the sun has risen on him, there shall be blood guilt for him. He shall surely pay. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If the stolen beast is found alive in his possession, whether it is an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. All right, so here we have a situation where attempted robbery is being taken place. And God says that if the thief breaks in at night, that if the owner happens to kill the thief, that the owner does not bear responsibility for blood guilt or for murder. And God has probably two reasons in mind here. Number one, it's dark. You have no idea whether the person is coming in just to take a few items or whether the person is coming in to murder you. You can't tell if the person has a weapon or not. And so God says you have a right to defend yourself in this situation. The other thing to keep in mind is that so often we are not with it when we wake up in the middle of the night. When we've been in a deep sleep and we are alarmed when we are woke up, we are often not with it at all. About a year ago, there was one particular evening. I lay on the bed, and then we have a nightstand next to us and then a lamp that sits on the nightstand. And I was like dreaming that somehow this lamp had got knocked off the nightstand. And so I like reached over and like grabbed the lamp. And I'm like holding on to it. All of a sudden I can hear, like I'm half sleeping, half awake, like still dreaming. But like I hear Jen say, "Matthew, put the lamp down." And I'm thinking like, "Jen, I caught it. Like I caught it. I caught the lamp. Like it was falling and I caught this lamp." She's like, "Matthew, put the lamp down." And I'm like, "I know, I caught it. Like, I caught it." Like, I was, like, so proud of myself that somehow someone had come in and, like, knocked this lamp over, and I had caught it. And so I, like, you know, like, loosened my grip on the lamp and set it down, and I must have, like, fallen asleep just right after that. And, like, the next morning, I woke up, and I'm, like, laying in there in bed, like, with Jen, and I'm just like, "Did, like, the lamp almost knock over last night, and, like, I caught it?" And she's like, "No, you knocked over the lamp." Like, and she's like, "And you're holding it in the air." And I'm like, she was like freaking out that I was going to take this lamp and like hit her with it. Like, so she's like, "Put the lamp down," you know. And I'm just, I had no idea what was going on. I thought that someone had knocked over this lamp and I had like miraculously like woke it up just in time to like catch this lamp. Like I thought I saved the lamp, and she is terrified. But that's why God says if someone breaks into the house at night, that the person is not responsible if they defend themselves. But it says, if the sun has risen on him, there shall be blood guilt for him. If the sun has risen on him, there shall be blood guilt for him. And so God says, daytime is different because you can tell if the person is coming in to rob you or if the person is coming in with intent to kill you. And so you have time to make that decision. You have time to alert neighbors that more than likely you're going to have time to react. And God says that more than likely, if you take this person's life, it's because you were intentionally trying to kill them rather than out of self-defense. But if a person robs, God says he shall surely pay. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If the stolen beast is found alive in his possession, whether it's an ox or donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. So God says, obviously this person that is trying to break in, that is trying to rob this person, probably doesn't have much. But God says that doesn't suffice. You can't just say, "You know what, I don't have any money. I can't pay back what I stole from you. I can't pay back what you lost." God says, "Nope, you have to work that off. You have to work that off, and slavery, you shall surely pay." Next situation, verse 5, it says, "If a man causes a field or vineyard to be grazed over or lets his beast loose and it feeds another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best in his own field and his own vineyard." Most fields back in this time didn't have fences, and so it was pretty common for livestock to wander over into a neighbor's field. But it was the responsibility of the farmer or shepherd to make sure that you kind of stayed on your own grass or stayed on your own field, because grass and fruits and vegetables and all that stuff were a pretty rare commodity. And so God says that if your livestock cross over into someone else's property and eat what someone else has grown, then you have a responsibility to make restitution, that you're supposed to let them over into your field so they can eat yours. If a fire breaks out and catches in thorns so that the stacked grain or the standing grain of the field is consumed, he who started the fire shall make full restitution. Once again, if you're starting a fire, if you're burning something and the flames leap over and burns your neighbor's field, you have a responsibility to make up for whatever grain or product or whatever commodity was over there. If a man gives to his neighbor money or goods to keep safe and is stolen from the man's house, then if the thief is found, he shall pay double. If the thief is not found, the owner of the house shall come near to God to show whether or not he has put his hand to his neighbor's property. For every breach of trust, whether it's for an ox, for a donkey, for a sheep, for a cloak, or for any kind of lost thing of which one says, "This is it," the case of both parties shall come before the Lord. The one whom God condemns shall pay double to his neighbor. All right, so if a man gives to his neighbor money or goods to keep safe, what's going on here is the family is traveling at this point in time, whether they're going to go see other relatives or whatever. And so back then, you didn't really have locks on doors. You didn't have a safety deposit box at the bank. You didn't have this giant safe gun safe, you know, like in your house to be able to store goods and merchandise. And so what you did is you often took it to your neighbor's house and they kept it for you. And so God says that if you come back and something is missing, if the thief is found, the thief shall pay double, just like in the above situation. But if the thief is not found, who's the guilty party, or who is most likely the guilty party in this? The neighbor who's watching the stuff, right? And so God says that the person shall come near to God and to show whether he's put his hand to his neighbor's property or not. That there would be a trial, a mini trial that would unfold as to whether this neighbor actually took the items or whether someone else actually snuck in and they couldn't just catch the thief. But if the neighbor took it, then the neighbor would pay double. If no one took it, then that's just kind of, you're out of luck there. All right, verse 10, if a man gives to his neighbor a donkey or an ox or a sheep or any beast to keep safe, so here the neighbor is taking care of the neighbor's livestock, and it dies or is injured or is driven away without anyone seeing it, an oath by the Lord shall be between them both to see whether or not he has put his hand to his neighbor's property. The owner shall accept the oath, and he shall make restitution. But if it is stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. If it is torn by beasts, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for what has been torn. It's kind of similar situation. If the neighbor is found guilty, he shall make restitution. If he's not found guilty, if the animals just wandered away or if they were eaten by other animals, then the neighbor was not liable. Verse 14, if a man borrows anything of his neighbor and it is injured or dies, the owner not being with it, he shall make full restitution. If the owner was with it, he shall not make restitution. If it was hired, it came for its hiring fee. So if you loaned anything from your neighbor, if you borrowed an animal, if you borrowed a tool and something happens to it, the animal dies, the tool gets broken or whatever, God says you should make full restitution if the neighbor or if the loaner is not there with you. If the owner is there with you, then it's just considered a lending fee. All right. So what do we get from all this? Well, like I said, it's not as simple as don't steal my neighbor's donkeys or oxen or sheep. In addition, I think it's easy for us to say, well, this is the passage that I've been looking for a long time, Pastor, because my neighbor has been taking my stuff for years. And now we can actually go to them and say, see right here in Exodus 21 and 22, where you not only have to pay me back what I owe, but you have to pay me back double, right? Isn't this a great passage? You guys get the stuff that you got, that you lent someone else, and you get a little tack on, right? Well, while we can apply the passage in that way, I believe the primary way the Lord would have us apply this passage today is not as the victim, but as the offenders. Therefore, our first point this morning is this, that we are all guilty of taking advantage and harming others. That's essentially what this passage comes down to, that the animal that falls into the pit harms the owner of the animal, that the ox that is butted or gored prevents the farmer from being able to plow the ground, that having property stolen, lost, or misused puts the owner of the property at a disadvantage, that all of us are guilty of this from time to time, whether we intentionally take advantage of others or unintentionally take advantage of others. Have you ever been over at someone's house and either broken an item while over there or potentially spilled something and permanently stained their carpet? Has your pet ever damaged any property of your neighbors? Have you ever invited someone over to your home to work on a project and they got hurt while helping you? Have you ever worked inefficiently at your job and thus stolen time and money from your employer? Have you ever borrowed something from someone else and returned it in worse condition than what you borrowed it? Or worse yet, have you ever borrowed something from someone else and the item is still in your house with little to no intention of returning it? As you probably think of these situations, you may be thinking, yeah, but what's the big deal? You know, sometimes the items that we're keeping that we haven't given back is like a $5, $6, $7 book. What's the big deal? But God is saying over and over in this passage that it is a huge, huge deal to him when we take advantage of others. That there is always restitution that must be made. That even the littlest things can damage relationships between two people. They can cause division. They can cause those outside the church to not want to hear opportunities or not want to hear the gospel. Just think about how many fences in our country have probably been built because someone's neighbor happened to destroy a little piece of property, either while they were mowing or their pet or some other accident. And the neighbor refused to apologize or refused to make amends. And so what happens? A fence goes up. The neighbors stop talking. They're bitter towards each other. God says taking advantage of others will not be tolerated in his community, that we must seek to make restitution. We must seek to make things right. So how do we do that? Well, for many of us, we apologize, right? We say we're sorry. It was an accident. I didn't mean to. My pet didn't mean to. My kid didn't mean to. You know, these kids these days, sometimes, you know, you just can't control them. But notice that in these laws, even in the cases when the offender didn't intentionally cause harm, he still had the responsibility to make things right. In verses 33 through 34, the man digging this hole didn't say, "Oh boy, here we go. I'm going to trap this ox and this donkey. I'm going to intentionally not cover this, or I'm going to put a rug over top of this thing, and then it's going to fall right in. It's going to be the best thing ever." He didn't intentionally do that. The oxen or the donkey wandered in and fell into the hole. But God says, you know what? You still have to pay him. You still have to make things right. You harmed the other person. You put them at a disadvantage. He has to make things right. I'm sorry doesn't cut it in God's eyes when we take advantage or harm others. Similarly, paying back a portion of what you owe doesn't suffice either. Notice two things in this passage. First, the thief who broke into the house has to pay. He has to pay. He has to pay something. He can't fall back on his inability to pay. God says, no, you have to work until you can pay that off. There is no, I can't afford it, so I'm just going to go. God says you have a responsibility to make things right. You have a responsibility to make a full payment. And notice that in all these situations when payment was made, there is none where the person was allowed to pay back only a portion of what they owed. As if to say, well, I can't afford the full price, but I'll pay back what I can. But that's not good enough in God's eyes, that you're still causing someone to be a victim. My dad, one of his purchases in his basement was this really nice, it was like an $85, $90 dartboard, like electronic dartboard that kept track of the score for you, lit up, I mean, just incredibly nice. And it was one of the favorite things for our youth group to do when we were over at my dad's house. And we had one kid in our youth group that was kind of always one of those, okay, I'm going to stand at the line that, you know, the standard line and kind of throw these darts. And, I wonder how accurate I could be if I step back. Okay, now I'm going to throw, okay, like doing pretty good. Okay, I'm gonna step back. Okay, yep, doing pretty good. All right, now I'm going to stand behind this chair over here and keep throwing darts. And he happened to toss one of them, and it went right through the visual display on the dartboard, and not only took out the visual display, but took out all the sound, period, on the dartboard. And so basically, he had to reduce this $85, $90 dartboard down to a $15, $20 dartboard that you had to keep track of score for yourself. You couldn't play various games on it. There was no sound to let you know what spot you had hit. And about 2 weeks later, he felt bad. He felt awful. But about 2 weeks later, he comes back, and he had purchased this $25 dartboard for me to take back to my dad. He said, could you please give this to my dad? I'm really sorry. And I'm just thinking, there's no way my dad is going to accept this as an apology. My dad is not going to say, all right, I'll hang this $25, $30 dartboard on the wall. I mean, that's essentially what he had on the wall already. You know, even broken, it's a $25, $30 dartboard. But this kid was essentially saying, this is all I can do. This is all I can do to make things right. And so he tried. But it just doesn't suffice, does it? It just doesn't fully make amends for what he did. So how are we to respond? If sorry doesn't cut it, if making a partial payment doesn't cut it, how do we right the wrong of taking advantage and harming others? It brings us to our next point, that as Christians, we should seek to make full amends when we take advantage of others. Notice in this passage, church, that the minimum payment that was required, the minimum payment that was required to make things right was equal to the value of what was lost. The minimum payment to make things right was equal to the value of what was lost. The reason, of course, is that God doesn't want the victim to walk away saying, man, I really got taken advantage of there. I loaned this thing to this person, and I got less coming back to me. This person's ox butted my ox and killed it. So he still has his ox, and I don't have mine, but he's going to make a partial payment. That God doesn't want the victim to be taken advantage of. And so God says, I want you to make at least a payment worth the item that you broke. That God wants the victim to walk away saying, at least I got back what was lost or broken or stolen. But notice in most situations, God actually asks the offender to pay back more than what was lost. That if you stole something and got caught, you had to pay back twice as much. If you killed, if one of your animals killed another animal, that sometimes it was two or three or four or five times the value of the animal. Church, this is the standard we have before us when we wrong others. That if we are over at someone's house and break an item, God is calling us to, at minimum, replace the full value of the item that was broken. If not, provide an upgrade. If our pets ever damage a neighbor's property, whether it's a fence or flowers or lawn, God is calling you to replace the fence, the flowers, the lawn, and not with a cheaper version of their fence or flowers or lawn, but the actual fence, flowers, or lawn, or even a step up. If we are guilty of working inefficiently at our job and thus have stolen time from our employer, we're called to make up that time. In fact, God probably calls us to make up that time and to work a little harder, to work even more time to make amends. If we ever borrow something from someone else, we're called to return it. And if we damage it, we're not only called to replace the damage, but improve their property. In doing so, we not only make amends for what we have done wrong, but we restore the relationship we have with the person. And we take the opportunity to bless them, to upgrade what they lost. The victim, in those cases, becomes the benefactor in the relationship. So we've now covered the righteous requirements of the law, but what about the grace of the gospel? How do we apply this passage through the lens of what Jesus Christ has done for us? For that, I want us to turn to Luke chapter 19. And you can leave your place in Exodus. You don't need a bookmark it. We'll spend the rest of our time here in Luke 19, beginning in verse 1. We're going to read about a man named Zacchaeus. How many of you guys sing the song whenever you hear the word? Yeah. Zacchaeus was a wee little man, and wee little man was he. Yeah, so we're going to read about Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus is a tax collector, but not only that, he's a chief tax collector. But not only that, he's a chief tax collector in Jericho. So there were kind of three main Jewish hubs where most of the taxes were collected, and Jericho was one of the main ones. And Zacchaeus is one of the chief tax collectors in one of the main hubs. So you can about imagine how much money this guy had. So with that in mind, let's read this story. It says, he being Jesus, entered Jericho and was passing through. And behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. Understatement there. And he was seeking to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not, because he was small in stature. So he ran on ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was about to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. So he hurried and came down and received him joyfully. And when they saw it, they all grumbled. He has gone into be the guest of a man who is a sinner. And Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold. And Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, since also he is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost. Well, in the Roman tax system, essentially the Roman government would essentially set the tax rate and say, you know, it's going to be this percentage. And then they would charge, or they would put these tax collectors in place to go out and actually collect the taxes. But what happened is these tax collectors wouldn't just collect the percentage that the Roman government had instituted. They would tack on a few extra percentages for their own personal profit. It would be like you going to your tax lady or tax man at this time and says, okay, you guys, based off your income, you fit into the 25% bracket this year, but I'm going to charge you 30. You'd be like, what? We're in the 25%. Like, why are you charging me 30? Well, that's just for me. That's just my cut off the top. That's what tax collectors did. I mean, imagine how much you'd feel ripped off if you went to your tax person and after they had done your taxes, yeah, that'll be 30%. I'm going to keep 5. I mean, you would hate this person. I mean, you would be ready to storm out of the office, and that's how people reacted to these tax collectors. And Zacchaeus is one of the chief tax collectors, and he is making tons and tons of money off manipulating all these people. That is until he meets Jesus, or at least until Jesus seeks him out. Jesus could have ignored Zacchaeus as he walked by, just like Jesus could have ignored us, the modern-day Zacchaeuses, as we take advantage of those around us. But Jesus comes to seek and save what was lost, and so he invites Zacchaeus to come down and invites himself over to Zacchaeus' home. I would imagine that Zacchaeus probably almost fell out of the tree. Me? A sinner? A tax collector? You know, you're talking to me? A person who takes advantage of the very people that you are preaching and spending time with and healing? You must have another Zacchaeus. Like, this isn't, you can't be talking to me. I'm a huge sinner. You want to have dinner with me? And for us today, Jesus, you want to spend time with me? You want to invite me over to dinner? A sinner? Someone who's lazy at work and manipulates the system? Someone who borrows stuff from other people and doesn't return things or breaks things and just leaves it at their doorstep? Someone who mistreats my neighbor, someone who takes advantage of others, you want to spend time with me? And Jesus says, yes. Yes, I do. Invite me into your home. The passage says that Zacchaeus is overjoyed and receives Jesus joyfully. And we see from the rest of the section that this isn't only just into his house, that Zacchaeus places his trust in Jesus, that he receives Jesus into his life, that he believes the good news of who Jesus is and receives salvation, that the gospel changes Zacchaeus' heart. And church, look at what the gospel does in his heart. Look at the overflow of Christ's love in Zacchaeus' life. He says in verse 8, Lord, half of my goods I give to the poor. What? Half? He's going to give half of all of his goods to the poor. Church, that's not a 50% tithe out of his paycheck. That is half of all he owns. Half his house, half his possessions, half his clothes, half his money. All gone. He's going to give it to the poor. He's going to give it to those in need. But that's not all. He says, if I have defrauded anyone, I will restore it fourfold. Fourfold, church! He's going to restore it fourfold. You know what he was required to do by the law? We saw where if a man stole money from someone else and never confessed it, he had to repay back what? Twice. He had to repay back twice of what he owed. What if the man confesses it like Zacchaeus is doing? Let's look up here at the verse in Leviticus chapter 6. It says, if anyone sins and commits a breach of faith against the Lord by deceiving his neighbor in a matter of deposit or security, or through robbery, Zacchaeus' case, or if he has oppressed his neighbor, has found something lost and lied about it, swearing falsely, and if in any of all the things that people do and sin thereby, if he has sinned and has realized his guilt, and will restore what he took by robbery or what he got by oppression or the deposit that was committed to him or the lost thing that he found or anything about which he has sworn falsely, he shall restore it in full, 100%, and shall add a fifth to it and give to him to whom it belongs on the day he realizes his guilt. Zacchaeus was obligated by the law to give 120% of what he had taken. And he is giving 400% back. 280% more than what the law required of him. In addition to giving away half of what he owned. Who does such a crazy, crazy thing? Someone who has met Jesus. Someone who has experienced Christ's overwhelming love and grace towards sinners like you and I. That though we take advantage of others constantly in our daily lives, Jesus hung on the cross so those sins would be paid for. And Zacchaeus shows us that once this grace takes root in our lives, it results in overwhelming generosity towards others. Out of the joy of what Christ has done for us, we begin to share God's grace with those around us. Which leads us to our final point. That our joy in the gospel should lead us to becoming faithful borrowers and generous givers. Do you see the Old Testament, or the difference between the Old Testament law and the New Testament, church? That as you read through the Old Testament, most people read this with a mentality of, all right, what's the minimum I have to do in order to please God, in order to make things right with my neighbor? You want me to pay back 100% of what I owe? Okay, I'll do it. Yeah, I stole something. Okay, I'll pay back twice. Yeah, I stole an animal. I'll provide 5 oxen, 4 sheep, whatever. Just let me know what the punishment is. What is the minimum I have to do in order to make things right with others and stay right with God? But then we encounter Christ. We meet Jesus, or yet Jesus meets with us. He chooses to eat and dine with sinners like you and I. He even goes on to die for sinners like you and I. And suddenly the whole game changes. Suddenly our approach is not to do the minimum that the law requires. The grace of Jesus gives us such great joy that we don't want to do the minimum anymore. That we want to pass on the same grace and the same generosity that the Lord has given us to those we meet. That we want to say, out of the abundance of what God has given me, I want to give abundantly to others as well. That suddenly we don't just want to borrow other stuff and return it as is, that we want to return it in better shape than how we received it. That we want to become faithful borrowers. And we don't just want to give the minimum that was required, because Jesus didn't just give the minimum. Jesus gave all he had, and we become people who want to give more than what others deserved. That Jesus didn't say, I'm going to give you what you deserve. Jesus said, I'm going to give you more than what you deserve. I'm going to give you abundantly more than what you deserve. And we become people who are changed by the gospel, who are changed by Christ's love, and we become people who want to give more than what others deserve. Church, if we truly want to make disciples in the city, let us do 2 things with this passage. First, simply let us not be known in this community as people who take advantage of others. Once we leave here, let's begin to take steps to make amends for what we have done wrong. If you have borrowed something from someone and have not yet returned it, return it. It is not yours, it is their property. If you have broken something of someone else's, begin to work to repay it. Begin to work to make things right. Begin to patch things up. Don't let your neighbor look at you constantly as the person who has taken advantage of them. Let's not be that church. Let's be the church that, secondly, as we reflect on what Jesus has done for us as sinners, in our joy, let's seek to be the best neighbors by becoming faithful borrowers and generous givers. Church, it should be a blessing for every person in Muscatine County to have a neighbor from this church. It should be a blessing for them to say, I know someone from First Baptist. because of our generosity, because of how we treat others, because of how we make things right when we treat others poorly. That our neighborhoods would be filled with people who are, I got to move next to someone from First Baptist. I want to be in a neighborhood with someone from First Baptist because those people live differently. Those people, they borrow your stuff and somehow you end up with better stuff in return. Those are the people that, I don't know how they do it, but they're always giving stuff away. They're always having us into our home. They always have an abundance, and they choose to share it with us. They don't go out and they buy a whole bunch of new things. They're the people that bless others. That I'm having troubles finding places in my house for all the blessings that they are trying to give me. That's the church that God is calling us to do. That's calling us to be. That's the church that is changed by the gospel, that is changed by the good news of what Jesus Christ has done for us. Let us be a church that lends our tools, lends our clothes, lends our vehicles, lends our books, and lends our time willingly to love others. Let us use extra grocery money to provide meals or desserts for someone or to invite others into our homes. Let us be a church that says, you know what, this facility we have, it's too massive. It doesn't get used enough. Let's open it up to our community. Let's figure out ways to bless our community. And then when they come here, that we would say, you know what? You can go rent the community building. You can go rent another facility in town, but they're not going to take care of you like we are. They're not going to love you like we are. They're not going to provide this gift of hospitality like we are. They're not going to be the best neighbors. Jesus Christ has changed our lives, and we want you to see the gospel at work in our church. Let us leverage whatever abundance we have to love on others so they would ultimately come to know Jesus. Philip Ryken says, it is good to stop stealing and better to pay back what we owe. But best of all, to give away what is ours for Jesus. Churches, we seek to make disciples here in Muscatine because Jesus has given generously to us. Let us be the church that is changed by the gospel, that is changed by the good news. And we would seek to give away what is ours so that ultimately others will come to know Christ as we do. Let's pray. God, as we confessed our sin earlier, for the times that we take advantage of others, Father, we come before you now and we thank and praise you that your grace has covered those sins. We thank you for the forgiveness that we have in your Son, Jesus. And Father, we just reiterate the prayer from earlier that, Father, that you would just change our hearts into becoming people who are grateful and thankful and so changed by the good news of the gospel, so changed by the love that was displayed on the cross through your Son, Jesus. That, Father, that we would become people who not only seek to make amends when we have wronged others, but, Father, people who would give abundantly out of what you have provided for us. Father, help us to be the church that is the best neighbors to those around us. That others will count themselves blessed to be near us, to live close to us. Not because of how great we are, but because of how great you are in us. And so, Father, would you increase the Spirit? Would you increase your work in our lives? Would you conform us ever more to your Son, that, Father, that we could be that light to our community in this way? And Father, we just pray that for all who come into our homes as we open them up, for all who come into our church as we open them up, that, Father, that they would see Jesus here, that they would encounter Jesus here, that you would change their lives here, that they would come to know a Savior, inviting them to a meal. encourage them to invite him into their lives. These things we ask in your Son's name.